Live from the Ken and Valerie Baker Studio at WHYY, this is Studio 2.
On Monday, June 15th, welcome, 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 friends, on Into the Program. I'm Cherry Gregg.
I'm Avi Wolfman-Arendt.
So for decades, when it comes to work, there was a script. You got a job, you stayed there for years, you climbed the ladder, and then maybe one day you retire with a pension and maybe somebody would throw you a party. But today,
that'd be really nice.
Yeah, after decades, right? But today, that old script is no longer a reality. Artificial intelligence is reshaping how and who gets a job, and it's shifting the type of tasks we thought only humans can do. Plus, more people than ever are juggling multiple jobs, and the pandemic transformed where and how we work. And if we talk about young people, they are entering the workforce and they are not sure what careers will even look like a decade from now. And so what happens when the old rules, the old script no longer applies? How do we navigate a work world where the only constant is change? And so today on the show, we're exploring the future and present day state of work. And of course, we would love to hear from you. How has your work life changed in recent years? Are you working more or juggling multiple jobs? How's your work-life balance? Do you work in a different place now? Do you work at home? Is it hybrid? What is it? And how has AI affected your job? Is it in the office? How's it going? You can give us a call. The number is 888-477-9499. The email is studio2@whyy.org. And if you're working on, but if you're on Facebook or
if
YouTube.
If you're wink, wink working.
Yeah, you can put your comments in the chat. And a lot has changed. I mean, I remember, you know, most people came to the office before the pandemic. Now there's like a few days a week where everybody's kind of here. But then those other days, it's pretty thin in the office. But not, we're here every day.
Yeah, not for me.
We're here every day. So
we get our weekends off.
Yeah, that's true.
But yeah, we're Monday to I actually feel like sometimes I do feel like a relic of a bygone era when I tell my friends, "Yeah, I'm like 9 to 5 Monday through Friday." They're like, "Really?" Yeah, really.
Yeah.
Anyway, so we're curious how work has changed for you. 888-477-9499, email studio2@whyy.org, YouTube, Facebook. Leave a comment in the live chat. First, a trio of local news stories. And we start with a really scary and tragic incident Saturday night when a man allegedly shot three police officers in the city of Philadelphia before police then killed him. According to our news partners, 6ABC, this incident took place in the far west Philadelphia neighborhood of Winfield.
Yeah.
Officials say there was a confrontation between the officers and a 57-year-old man named Eric Franks. Police say Franks approached the officers as they were establishing a crime scene perimeter for a separate shooting incident. This first incident reportedly had nothing to do with this man, Eric Franks, other than the fact that it seemed to be near a place of business for him. There was some sort of argument that ensued. Franks drew a weapon, hit three officers, including one in the face. All of those officers are expected to survive. However, police say officers then returned fire, killing Eric Franks. According to his family, Franks is a former Marine, a business owner, and a recently retired Philadelphia firefighter. There are so many questions still unanswered, chiefly how could this encounter have escalated so quickly?
Yeah, the questions over how this could have happened were all over my timeline this weekend. A lot of people confused because they talked about Franks. They said he was licensed to carry his firearm, by the way. He was an upstanding guy. That's according to people who knew him. But the video clearly shows that there was some kind of confrontation and that Mr. Franks allegedly drew his weapon. But we don't know what was said because you can't really hear audio. And so the lawyer representing Franks and his family has asked that people reserve judgment until the full investigation is complete. So there are a lot of questions. The good news is the three officers who were shot are going to be okay.
Yep.
Yeah. A second story, Pennsylvania State Police gave out hundreds of tickets to people driving while holding a cell phone or other device over the course of just 3 days. And if you did not know, the Pennsylvania ban on using handhelds while driving became law in June of last year. But there was like a 1 year warning period.
Yeah, like a ramp up.
Ramp up. Yeah, where you just got warnings. Then this June, the law went into effect And the Inquirer reports that the state police cracked down on enforcement, handing out nearly $750 citations for violations of the law and more than 300 warnings just between Monday and Wednesday of last week. Mm. And to help you understand the scope of this, they only gave around 1,600 warnings between June of last year through June of this year. So wow. 1,600 in a year.
And then 700 in 3 days.
In 3 days. And so they were busy. the law is called Paul Miller's Law. It's named after a man by the name of Paul Miller, who was killed in 2010 by a distracted tractor trailer driver. And under the law, it is illegal for a driver to have a cell phone in their hand at any time while operating a vehicle. And there are no exceptions for people waiting at red lights or stop signs or waiting in traffic when it stands still. So people think, oh, I'm at the stop sign. Click, click. Let me just check this text.
Not allowed.
That is not allowed. And if the police officers catch you, you will get a $50 fine. And they said the only exception is for emergencies and you have to pull over to use your phone safely.
Yeah, I wonder how this is all going to level out, because like you said, the 700 citations in those few days is way out of whack with what they had been doing during the warning period. So is that just sort of like to make people aware, or is this really going to be the pace moving forward?
Yeah, it's I don't know how they can keep that pace up, but I do think that distracted driving is a real problem. 3,200 people died in 2024 due to distracted drivers, and hundreds of thousands of accidents were caused due to distracted driving, and people have been injured. So this is a real thing across the country, and I think they're just trying to crack down on it and have people take it seriously.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, it's a warning for me. I'll try to remember that next time I'm behind the wheel.
Yep, for sure.
So there's a lot of stories these days about how expensive real estate is down the shore. But there's a story that just came out in the Philadelphia Business Journal that even in that context blew my mind. Mm-hmm. So let's pull up this story here. This is a tiny little, look at that cute little
yellow
cottage, 760 square feet, North Wildwood, like just tiny, tiny little grandma
tiny
cottage, North Wildwood. It is on the market for $2.3 million.
Cha-ching.
$2.3 million. Mm. If it goes for that price, it would be the most expensive property per square foot in the history of the Wildwoods. The reason it's so expensive is not because of the house, Cherry.
Oh, no.
It's because the lot is pretty big and it's in a prime location. But still, $2.3 million for a tiny little cottage on North Wildwood gives you a sense of just how insane real estate has gotten down there. And by the way, according to the Business Journal, the Wildwoods, that zip code, it is the 10th hottest real estate market in America, in the whole country. And Ocean City, New Jersey is fifth. So two zip codes down the Jersey Shore are among the 10 hottest zip codes in the entire country in terms of real estate values going up.
But I say to offer to sell it at that price is one thing, but then to buy it at that price is a totally different thing. I mean, it's a cute house. You saw it, yellow, adorbs. But $2.3 million just seems like it's a lot. And I know that they said the lot, the square footage of the actual lot is bigger, but it's not huge. It's like 5,900 square feet, the actual lot. So you got to tear that house down.
Yeah.
I know. Yeah. You got to tear that house down and spend even more money to build a house.
Right.
It just goes to show you how hot that area is. But I don't know. I'm like, I wonder if it's a free ad. I'm a little skeptical. I don't think it's going to go for $2.3 million.
Well, even if it went for $1.3 million.
It's still high. But I mean, I think they're getting it talked about. People are going to see this lot. They say, oh, you know what? I'll offer you, less than this. And they'll sell it for less. But
that would be a bold marketing strategy.
It's a great
to wildly overprice something.
People
weren't going to find out about this cottage. They can't do it the normal way.
I just feel like, no, I'm not saying that. But I'm just like 2.3. That's the highest of the houses. They have a house. And I saw this. They have a house that is brand new. On an even slightly bigger lot that costs around $2.3 million as well.
Yeah, but this is the hottest housing market
in
America.
But so it's in the same area.
I don't know. I don't know if they get 2.3. Even if they get 2, even if they get 1.8,
It's still a great price, yeah.
And at this point, I mean, I just hope, someone's got to preserve one of these cottages and, turn it into a museum, because they're all They're all gonna be gone soon. I looked at like the Google Street View for this neighborhood, and this house is completely surrounded by like two-story behemoths. And there's one little pink house on the same street. And I'm looking at the pink house, and I'm looking at the little yellow house, and it's almost like they're winking at one another. And the yellow house is gonna be gone soon.
I know.
So someone save that pink house. We got to save one of these cottages.
And this used to be a working class neighborhood, you know. And now that was like 30 years ago, and nowadays. I mean, $2.3 million for a 700-plus square foot cottage.
The ocean is a limited commodity. They're not making more of it.
I know.
And that's what happens.
Yeah.
You have to work a lot to afford one of these cottages. And we're going to talk about work life, how it's changing. This is a whole new era for work, folks. We want to hear how your job's changing. Give us a call. Shoot us an email. We'll be right back.
Welcome back to Studio 2 here on WHYY. I'm Cherry Gregg.
I'm Avi Wolfman-Arendt. American workers have faced some big disruptions in recent years. First, of course, there was the pandemic, which introduced hybrid and remote work to millions of workers. And now, AI is poised to shake things up all over again.
Yeah, a lot of people are thrilled to get to work remotely, but we're learning there are some serious downsides to what seems like a job perk. And today, more people than ever are working multiple jobs, some to make ends meet and others by choice to get a leg up in their career. That's called polyworking.
So today we're talking about all the ways work has changed and where things are headed. And we would really love to hear from you this hour. Great hour for audience participation, we think.
Yeah.
We want to know, how has your job changed? Has it gotten easier, harder? Have you found the secret sauce to work-life balance? And if you are new to the job market, are you having trouble breaking in? Give us a call, 888-477-9499. Our email is studio2@whyy.org. If you're on YouTube or Facebook, drop a comment in the live chat and then X out if the boss comes by.
Oh, yeah, for sure. We've got two great guests to walk us through the workplace revolutions and how we can best respond to them. We have Callum Borchers, on the clock columnist covering workplace trends for The Wall Street Journal. And we also have Christy McAlpine, assistant professor of management at Rutgers Business School, Camden. Callum and Christy, welcome to Studio 2.
So glad to be with you.
Thanks for having me.
All righty. So let's start with the trend of yesterday, which is remote work. I'm just curious, Callum, like, have we settled into a new normal now with remote work in terms of the percentage of people that are doing it, the amount of, you know, time an average worker is spending remote per week versus in person? Like, is there a new normal that we can point to? And what does that new normal look like if it exists?
I think we haven't quite settled just yet, except that the changes now are much more incremental, right? So, you know, for a while you had these sort of like big return to office mandates and you'd see big upticks in the shares of workers who were back in the office. So we've sort of hit a plateau, but it's not perfectly flat. I mean, I was writing at the beginning of this year, and I think this has only continued, about the sort of like unspoken pressures that draw workers back into offices. One way, for example, that some companies do this is they'll tie promotions or raises to in-office presence, either explicitly or implicitly, right? Mm. I mean, you know, they might just, you just notice, hey, I noticed Cherry got a promotion because you know, she seems to show face in the office a whole lot, you know, and that sends a signal to other people on the staff. So what we see is that some of the, it's happening on the margins, I guess you could say, where the Mondays and the Fridays that were the work from home
days, no more,
we're in the office more.
You're not seeing the big like policy changes as much as you're just seeing like little tweaks. And I'm curious then, if that's the case, like we're kind of now operating in a like sort of smaller range of possibilities. Like, can you give us either some numbers or some anecdotal information that tells us about where we've landed? Like, is the average person going in a couple times a week, one time a week? The percentage of jobs that are like fully remote, has that changed much? Callum, I'm just curious if you have any information you can provide there.
Yeah, I mean, well, on remote work, for one thing, that is, you know, down significantly, right? I mean, if you looked in the height of the pandemic, you know, let's say early 2022 was probably the peak of remote work job postings. If you look at both LinkedIn and Indeed data, and you had double-digit shares of jobs that were posted, or at least they were advertised as fully remote, that's down to more like 8%. So it's not like it's gone totally off a cliff, but it's appreciably smaller. And also keep in mind, it's a smaller slice of a smaller pie, right? Because there are fewer job openings, period, mm-hmm. now, never mind just remote job openings. Your question, Avi, about like number of days in the office, I think 2 and 3 is pretty typical, although a lot of companies have gone back to five full days in the office right now. And so, you know, the biggest thing that I think is happening to a lot of workers is that ability to kind of flex your Monday or Friday, mm-hmm. right, and make that your work from home day. So you kind of ease into the weekend or ease back into the work week. That is starting to go by the wayside. And we're the office attendance numbers on Mondays and Fridays is now closer to what it was on, say, like a Wednesday or a Tuesday a few years ago.
So bosses are still pushing to try to get more people back in the office physically. Is that push still happening?
At many companies, it is. I mean, I will say, look, there are some that see this as a strategic advantage, right? I mean, there are plenty of companies that have said, we're going to go fully remote. It's often sort of like smaller or startup businesses mm-hmm. because that's how they can compete for top talent, right? You know, so you've seen these big RTO mandates from the Amazons, the Metas of the world. They don't have to make those concessions, right? They're the big guys. People clamor to work for those companies. It's often the other firms that are saying, I want to kind of, how do I entice maybe a Meta or Google caliber person to come work for me? One way you can do that is to throw them a bone and let them have a little more flexibility.
And so, Chrissy, I want to bring you into the conversation because we're hearing from Callum, look, you know, that work from home thing that so many people embraced, and it gave workers this freedom. Well, a little less freedom. What other things are you seeing that are shifting in the way that we work and where we work right now?
Yes, definitely. So I think, you know, with moving to remote work, you know, there's a lot of new challenges that workers are facing. So it is a, you know, potential perk. And Callum mentioned some of the, you know, talent management implications that offering flexible work provides for organizations. But from a worker perspective, I mean, it's really, you know, it's a new way to manage one's work, you know, work home boundaries. I mean, suddenly, you know, workers, so the most people who are working remotely are working from their home. Mm-hmm. So suddenly work is coming into the home. Suddenly, you know, family members can interrupt them. Suddenly they have the ability to do new tasks that they never had the opportunity to do throughout the day, which on the one hand is really nice. And there's a reason that lots of folks really enjoyed working from home during the pandemic. They realized they could kind of intersperse these things. But it really comes with, you know, a cost in terms of the self-regulatory resources that one needs. So basically the effort that it takes you to manage your workday, be able to be disciplined about getting your work done, and managing the numerous distractions. You know, on top of that, you also think about things like social isolation. So my work and work of others has documented that when folks are working remotely for a higher share of their work week, they tend to feel more isolated. So how do we balance some of those you know, positive aspects of having, you know, autonomy and flexibility with some of the downsides, like that isolation, like those blurrier boundaries, and, you know, interruptions from family members.
And I do wonder, though, because if you're a younger worker and you're still learning your, you know, your profession or whatever, I know when I was very new, being in the office was so helpful for mentorship relationships and things like that. Did you see a divide between people who were more firmly established in their career versus younger workers when you talk about remote work?
I think that's a great question. I think I think it's often framed in terms of Gen Z or younger workers, but I think this is something that affects all workers in terms of, you know, when you join an organization or you take on a new job role, there's a really critical period at the beginning where you're being socialized. You're understanding what are the unwritten rules of the organization, what are the performance expectations, you know, who's really got the power around here. So what are the kind of informal status dynamics and power dynamics in the organization? And it's just frankly harder to suss all of those things out when you're dealing with technology mediated communication for more of the time. So I think, you know, it's a question that certainly younger workers are facing, but I think all workers, as they settle into new roles and take on new opportunities, are having to navigate really incredibly complicated dynamics, you know, over new technologies that really flatten the sort of richness of the communication and make it more challenging to pick up on more of those subtle cues.
Yeah.
We'd love to hear from you this hour, 888-477-9499, email studio2@whyy.org. We're talking about the present and future of work. We are curious, how has your job changed in recent years? Easier, harder? Have you found the secret sauce to work-life balance? Aaron says, I retired. That's my secret sauce. Okay, Aaron.
All right.
Calm down, man.
Rub it in, huh?
Yeah, seriously. Aaron's just chilling on a Monday.
Uh-huh.
Again, the number 888-477-9499. So, Callum, I am curious. I know we're going to move on from remote work soon, but, like, there was a possible path early pandemic where people said, look, this remote work thing, it's just going to take off. It's going to become a huge part of our work culture. It's not going to be 8-9%. It's going to be 20-30%. And basically that prediction centered on the idea that employers would realize that their workers were just as productive remote and they didn't want to spend money on offices. Offices are really expensive to maintain. So why not just let them work remotely? And that's what the workers were going to want as well. It feels like that hasn't really played out. And I'm curious why, like what have companies and maybe even workers discovered that maybe wasn't apparent in the earlier days of the pandemic?
I mean, if I boil it down to one word, it's leverage. Mm-hmm. I mean, I think in a lot of ways, it's really that simple. I mean, at the height of the remote work shift, workers had the leverage. You know, You saw it. I mean, we remember the good old days, right? When your LinkedIn inbox used to be flooded with recruiters saying, hey, here's this opportunity, right? Like companies were hiring like mad coming out of the pandemic, and they had to make some concessions to workers. This is, as Christy said, this is a perk that a lot of people want. They want
the flexibility. But why did they conclude that that was a concession? Like, I thought there was a possibility that this would even be an incentive, right, for companies. Be like, let's send more people remote.
Yeah.
We don't have to pay to clean the office. We don't have to pay the rent on the office space. And people are getting just as much done. Did that just turn out to not be true?
Well, a couple of things on that. I mean, one is, if you happen to hit the cycle just right, the lease cycle for an office, maybe it worked out fine. But a lot of these businesses, remember, they sign very long-term leases, right? So, I mean, if you're a corporation and you've got a 10, 20, 30-year lease on your office building, you know, you're paying that regardless, whether you've got butts and seats or not. So you'd rather have them in. And oh, by the way, sometimes the tax breaks that you got from a municipality were tied to having workers in those offices. So sometimes there's a practical reason to getting them back in. And the other thing, I mean, you mentioned productivity, Avi. A lot of workers love to point to some of the early productivity data from the pandemic that said, look, we were just as productive at home as we were in the office. The managers I talk to say there are a couple really big asterisks on that. Number one is that productivity and collaboration was built on pre-existing in-person relationships. Right? So maybe Christy and I used to work together. We sat and she and I can have a good working relationship remotely because we already know each other. You know, 6-7 years in now, we don't have that same built in. And the second thing too is the world was shut down. We didn't have all these distractions, right? So if you couldn't knock off and go to the gym and whatever in the workday anyway. Now, you know, you've got a lot of choices if you want to have some diversion during the workday. So bosses don't trust you as much during the workday. And also they're not convinced that the productivity, I think it's a honeymoon period, basically. Yeah. They thought you were really productive for a while and they don't think it's going
to
last.
And I wonder, I saw you nodding your head, Christy, to that one, because I wonder if some people took advantage of, you know, having that managers looking at them. They're at home. Did some people take advantage and sort of make it bad for the rest of the folks at all?
I'm really glad that Callum brought that up, the word trust, because I was thinking my answer to the prior question. I mean, leverage is a good word, but also trust. You know, so before the pandemic, there were trends, you know, an uptick in remote work. And so the COVID pandemic really accelerated that. But really, the core tensions that have also always existed have just become more apparent. And one of those central ones is around this trust and, you know, this understanding about what performance is and how do we measure that? How do we hold people accountable? You know, so if you think about a typical, you know, traditional job, you're going to the office from say 9 to 5, your supervisor's there, maybe they're down the hall, they can see you working, they can see that your butt is in the seat. And that's how they know you're working, right? And so when you think about, you know, working remotely, you're outside of the office, suddenly there's this question about, you know, can I trust that you're doing the work you're supposed to be doing? How do we know whether you're doing? How do we know if you're taking breaks that you're not supposed to or taking advantage as you framed it? And I think this puts the burden on organizations to think about, you know, how do we define good performance here? How do we understand what a good enough deliverable is? What is expected of workers and what timeline? And so then, you know, knowing that in advance and having the ability for leaders to clarify that, articulate that to workers so that they know what they're supposed to be doing. That shifts the framework from how much are you working, when are you working, to How effective are you vis-a-vis those organizational deliverables? And I think that really liberates us from this super, the surveillance kind of focus and whether workers are doing what they're supposed to be doing at any given moment of the day.
Yeah, I want to read a couple comments. Aaliyah on Facebook says, I absolutely detest Center City and literally quit a job because I had to go there daily. She also says she thinks people are realizing in this economy that two incomes is not a suggestion. It's a requirement, unfortunately. And Manuel writes, my job is doing a 3-day-a-week minimum coming in August or September. I really can't complain because they held out this long. However, I get much more done at home and put in more hours, 10 to 12 hours a day. I want to sort of shift a little bit because we talked about the work from home, but workers are sort of like reclaiming their time doing something called micro shifting. Callum, could you explain what that is and how it works?
Well, you're helping us do that right now. I did a little work this morning. I get to take a little break to come talk to you in the middle of the afternoon. Then I'll do some more work this afternoon. I mean, basically, you're breaking your workday up into little micro shifts, as the name suggests, right? So an example might be, pick a working parent, let's say, right? Maybe you get up early before the kids are out of bed. You knock out a few emails, all right? Then you cook some breakfast, get them on the bus, all right? Now you're back to work for a little while, little lunch break. You get the idea, right? You're sort of breaking your workday up into small shifts, sometimes as a convenience, right? So that you can accommodate some personal tasks and build them around your professional life. Some managers are actually okay with this, I think, because they understand that like there's a limit to how much deep work or how long you can concentrate in one full long stretch. So if breaking it up into smaller bits works for you, some managers are okay with that. I think it kind of comes down to whether the role that you're in is kind of like an output-based role, right? So let's say you're in sales, right? I mean, you either are hitting your targets or you're not hitting your targets. I can measure that. As Christy said, that's a big question with the trust, right? It's like, can I measure your productivity? So that can work okay. But if your role is more like, hey, you just need to be available on a moment's notice, then maybe the continuous shift is sort of where you're stuck.
Yeah, I wonder, Christy, haven't we always been doing that, though? I mean, I guess if you have a job where you just have to be at a place in person for 8 hours, that's different. But I've always worked in capacities where sometimes you do have to work a little later. So you take a little bit of the afternoon to handle some personal stuff since you know you have to be on call till 8 or 9 o'clock at night. Is this a new thing or are we sort of formalizing it now?
I think it's a great question. The way I see it is that this is a new term for something that we've been talking about for a long time, at least in the research literature. I would call it autonomy. I would call it schedule autonomy. I think the key thing is sometimes we talk about flexibility, some of these new work arrangements, and we conflate it with autonomy. And so while some workers do have that autonomy to, say, micro shift, where they're, making their breakfast, walking their dog, throwing in a load of laundry, there's lots of workers who have the ability, say, to work from home, but don't have that ability to micro shift because their employer is managing the terms of their day. So the processes, the way their tasks are going, think about like a call center worker. A call center worker can work from home. They can log into the same software they would have access to in the office. They might have call targets for that hour. They're not necessarily having the autonomy to pop out, walk their dog, make lunch and respond to something. So I think it's important that we clarify, when flexibility means autonomy and when it just means the same type of, say surveillance or performance management, but in a different location.
Yeah. We'd love to hear from you this hour. How has work changed for you in recent years? 888-477-9499. The email is studio2@whyy.org. DTMH on YouTube says the problem is companies want you in the office for 8 hours, but then expect you to be online and available after five. Mm-hmm. You can't have it both ways. Let's bring in a caller. This is Jamin from Lansdale on line one. Jamin, you're on Studio 2. What's your question or comment?
Hi, I'm Jamin. I'm not currently working right now, but I interned at a company last summer, and I want to talk a little bit about what that was like and what the work from home culture was like there.
Go right ahead.
Yeah, so it was pretty. I worked in an accounting firm, pretty large accounting firm. So it was pretty flexible. It depended on kind of what your manager wanted. Mm. So some people were in person almost 5 days a week working with a client because their client wanted them in person. And then other people, like my team, was in person typically just twice a week, Tuesdays and Thursdays. Mondays, Wednesdays, Fridays, people typically weren't in at all. I showed up my first day on Monday, and my manager actually asked if I was in the office. And I was like, of course I'm in the office. It's my first day.
Yeah.
And
real
then
quick, Jamin.
On my last day.
Yeah, real quick, Jamin. Sorry to cut you off. But you sound like a young person.
Yes.
This is like an early work experience for you. Was it, did having people be remote and on different schedules, did it make it easier, harder to meet people, integrate into the office culture? I'm curious for your perspective on that side of it.
Yeah, I would say it was a little more tough getting to know people. I had interned at a company the previous year and I was in person 5 days a week, so it was easier to get to know people there. But even this, people were super friendly, super nice on those Tuesdays, Thursdays I was there. I was brought into a lot of meetings. We had office happy hours. We had intern events after work. So by the end of the internship, I really felt like I'd got to know people, even though I'd probably only shown up to the office like 20 times. And I'd really, yeah, the whole summer. So it was,
well, Jamin, thank you for the call.
Much, but it was nice.
Yeah, thank you so much for the call. We wish you the best of luck out there and a very interesting perspective. Christy, I'm curious for your response to what Jamin said. What I found so interesting about that was the fact that even within the company, it seems like the rules were all over the place. Do you think that's typical these days? Like even within a single company, there could be this team is in the office 5 days a week. This team, just because of, you know, the eccentricities of that boss, is allowed to, you know, be mostly remote. Do you think that's typical?
I do think that's typical. So I think you see some differences across organization types, and you see that there are often across the board HR policies and practices that maybe set a floor or a ceiling on what is allowed. But you see a lot of kind of decentralization, so kind of team or unit level, you know, differences in terms of, you know, when and where workers are allowed to work. And I think that's a smart thing to do. So one thing that I think organizations have gotten wrong about, you know, flexibility policies and practices has been, you know, issuing these blanket across the board statements that maybe don't fit for all workers and all types of work. So, you know, I think having, you know, a lower level, so the manager level, work unit level decision really honors the fact that, you know, there are differences across the organization and, you know, one policy is not going to fit for everybody.
Yeah. And then the other part of that that I found interesting in that call, Callum, was the idea that, you know, this person had an internship. This is your chance to get the foot in the door, meet people, become part of like an office culture for, you know, one of the first times in your life. And they only went to the office like 20 times over the course of a summer. That's unfathomable to me. And I don't know how I would have figured out how to be like a worker. And I'm curious if there is data about that, if there's even if it's anecdata about like how young people are faring as they come to these offices where they might not even meet a lot of the people that they're working with all that many times.
Yeah, well, what I think is interesting in the survey data is that actually it's often those younger employees who are eager to be in the office, right? I mean, I think you heard it from Jamin there talking about sort of the value of the connections that he made there. And so they're not the ones who are super resistant. Often it's kind of in the middle. I mean, some of the offices in the U.S. now have kind of this donut phenomenon, right, where the senior leadership is in the office. And the entry level, you know, the interns and the young folks are in the office, right? And it's the, you know, it's the mid-career folks who've kind of, you know, they've established themselves enough and they want a little bit more flexibility.
And they might have young kids at home.
I was saying they may have young kids at home. I'm very, like, I got five, all right? So I'm sympathetic to them. All right, I got it, you know? But for, you know, for the executives, it can be kind of frustrating sometimes because those middle folks are the ones that you want the Jamins of the world to kind of learn from by osmosis. And if they're not there so often, you know, that process kind of get stunted. I mean, whether it's accounting, so many of these professional services type firms, they are apprenticeship, you know, type of businesses. And I think that is a real concern.
We're about to hit a break. I want to read this comment from Akram on YouTube. Akram's one of our regulars. Akram says, I work from home full time as a software engineer. I miss being in an office, but work from home has been a huge blessing because it allows me to care for my mom who has cancer.
Oh, wow.
Work from home has made me more loyal and dedicated to my company. Really interesting perspective. Thank you for sharing that, Akram. We'd love to hear from you all this hour. Studio2@whyy.org is the email. The number is 888-477-9499. Our question, how has your job changed in recent years? Give us a call, shoot us an email, and don't go anywhere. This is Studio 2. Thank you. And welcome back to Studio 2 on WHYY. I'm Avi Wolfman-Arendt.
And I'm Cherry Gregg. We are talking about the way we work today and how the workplace is changing. And we're getting advice on how to adapt to it, how to balance work and home life, how to deal with burnout, and how to break into the job market when AI is the gatekeeper.
Our guests today are Callum Borchers, on-the-clock columnist covering workplace trends for the Wall Street Journal, and Christy McAlpine, assistant professor of management at Rutgers Business School, Camden.
Yes, and we would love to hear from you, our listeners. How has your work life changed in recent years? Are you working more? Are you juggling multiple jobs? How's your work-life balance? And has AI entered your office? If so, how's it going? You can give us a call. The number is 888-477-9499. The email is studio2@whyy.org. And if you're watching on YouTube or Facebook, you can put your comments in the live chat. Nichelle on Facebook says, I work two in-person jobs 7 days a week. Edie on Facebook says, throughout most of my adult life, I've had several overlapping jobs, now including being a social worker and therapist. The major dynamic that changed is moving to telehealth during the pandemic. I still see some clients in person. So a lot of people juggling multiple jobs. And so I wanted to sort of ask you, Callum, I mean, this is becoming a thing. We're, according to the statistics, we're seeing more people than ever working multiple jobs. And a 2024 report by Deloitte showed that 45% of members of Gen Z and 36% of millennials either has a second full-time or part-time gig. Your thoughts on why we're shifting to this? Yeah.
Yeah, well, and some of it is young people for sure, and also for the rest of us too, just sort of like this sense of economic precarity. I mean, when I wrote about this topic recently looking at the Bureau of Labor Statistics data, I mean, the rate of people with multiple jobs was as high as it was during the recession of the aughts, right? So whether we're in a recession or not, we can't call, but we're side hustling or polyworking, to use the term of art, as if we were in a recession, right? And it was interesting to talk to some of these folks, by the way. Some of them were very explicit about that. That is their concern. They think we could be headed toward a recession, or they don't feel stable in one job, so they feel like they need to have a backup plan, right? So I think that's part of it. And then there is also, I mean, on the more positive side of things, right? Sometimes that second job can be a total change up, right? So, you know, I interviewed somebody, for example, who's got a conventional, you know, 9-to-5 desk job kind of thing. And then, you know, by night, she's like a DJ in nightclubs, right? Like just a totally different kind of thing. So it can also be a creative outlet for people sometimes too. At least I guess that's the best possible scenario. It's kind of fun. If you got to work two jobs, you may as well enjoy it.
Love being a DJ, right? Chrissy, your thoughts on that? Is this something that kind of always existed? Because I remember my mom had multiple jobs when I was a kid, right? But it just seems like more and more people are doing this. And sometimes people have multiple jobs concurrently, multiple full-time jobs concurrently.
Yeah, I mean, I think this is something that's always existed. And I think Callum pointed out some parallels in history. And I think one of the things that I always want to caution and kind of step back from when we're talking about multiple job holding, you know, whatever you call it, whether you call it polyworking or any of the other, you know, emergent terms, I mean, you're talking about workers responding to, you know, organizational opportunities and constraints, broader labor market opportunities and constraints. And sometimes that looks like, you know, the fun entrepreneurial side hustle that allows you to have more kind of task variety and build your skills. But more often than not, it looks like an economic constraint. It looks like, you know, someone needs to stitch together multiple jobs in order to make enough money and to have access to, say, benefits to allow them to, you know, live their lives in a you know, sustainable way. And I think when you see this uptick, it also speaks to, you know, the quality of jobs. We've seen a hollowing out of job quality over time. And if you think about these additional trends, you know, you've mentioned AI, we don't know what the future holds. But, you know, one thing I'd caution is to say, you know, it's not just quantity, it's quality. If workers had access to a quality full-time job with good pay and good benefits, I think you'd see a lot less of this multiple job holding. You might have some side hustles out there still. But I think people are doing this because they have to and not necessarily because they see it as a benefit to them.
If you want to chime in, give us a call, 888-477-9499. We're talking about the future of work. We're asking, how has your job changed in recent years? Again, the number 888-477-9499. The email is studio2@whyy.org. Natalie from Newark, Delaware says, I've been working from home since way before COVID, but at my company, we used to have annual in-person meetings. We don't do that anymore, and we've lost so much of the connection. Laura says, I've spent the last 16 years working at a TV station in person, Monday through Friday, 9 to 5, and I miss the early days of the pandemic when my now 90-minute commute went down to 50 minutes because there was less traffic. There's also been a growing grudge between my team, who has to be in person, and our managers and other coworkers who have the flexibility to work from home multiple days a week and get all the perks that you guys have mentioned. Christy, I'm curious how people are navigating that, the tension, because we talked about this earlier. Even within a company, some people are going to be more in person, some people are going to be more remote. And so can that create tension? And then how should managers and companies deal with that if it just feels unfair to people?
Yeah, I think that's absolutely a reality that some workers can face. And I think that's a risk that leaders have to consider, again, when they design these policies and when they decide how much discretion any given work unit or leader of that work unit has. You know, I think it needs to have a basis in the work that people do. So there needs to be an underlying logic that is, you know, clear and tied to the performance of the organization and how the worker is contributing to that. And it needs to be communicated clearly to workers. I think it's a lot easier for a worker to understand why, you know, their unit, which is, you know, client facing and, you know, needs to be out meeting, you know, with clients regularly on at their, you know, place of work, why they may not have as much access to flexibility as, you know, someone working in another area of the organization where they're doing, you know, tasks that are largely on, you know, an information system, you know, platform within the organization. I think if they can explain a logic, communicate that clearly, and then again, making sure that performance is held accountable in a fair way, then I think people can accept that. But I think we've not seen that consistent, you know, performance, you know, clarity and that communication across the board. And so I think workers are left to make their own assumptions about who deserves it and what feels fair to them. And I think that's to the detriment of the workers and the organization.
Yeah. I want to talk about artificial intelligence a bit because Lobster on YouTube says companies only care about the bottom line. That's why they're using AI. Companies don't like to pay their employees, let alone give them healthcare. Lobster had a lot of issues with the way the new state of work is. And so I want to talk about Callum, like how AI is being used to determine who gets a job, how they get a job, and then and sort of how it's impacting, because a lot of young people and a lot of folks who are in transition trying to get new jobs are seeing AI as being an obstacle in many ways. Could you explain how AI is interfering with the on-ramping of folks?
It's definitely a factor. It also may be a little bit less than we think, if that makes sense. Like I'm struck, for example, you know, the unemployment rate for new college grads, it hovers around 5% right now. So that's higher than the general population, for example, but that's hardly cataclysmic. It's not like it's wiped out all entry-level jobs. I also think, I mean, if we're blunt about it, job seekers love to throw out the reason why I didn't get that job because the AI screener just tossed my resume into a black hole, but that's not fair. I know I could do the job if only a human would look at it. That does happen sometimes. It's also possible that a more qualified person got the job ahead of you. And so there's a little bit of like narrative, a little bit of like self-assurance that we tell ourselves to comfort ourselves, like, oh, it's all AI's fault. And companies do this too, by the way, right? Mm-hmm. I mean, I've also written about this so-called AI washing phenomenon in which, you know, businesses that have made a mistake in some way or another, maybe they overhired during the pandemic and now they need to kind of course correct for that, or sales didn't live up to projections and they need to cut headcount to save expenses. It's a much more elegant story to tell the public and your shareholders, oh, we have these new AI efficiencies and so now we're having layoffs. It's a scapegoat, right? I mean, you sound like a cutting edge genius when you pin the layoffs on AI, as opposed to saying, yeah, I messed up. I overshot the growth calculation and now I need to fix it. So I would treat some of that you know, public rhetoric with some skepticism. It doesn't mean that AI isn't replacing some job functions. It absolutely is. I just think the scale, at least right now, is not maybe quite as widespread as some companies would like us to believe.
Well, lots of comments still coming in about remote work, including this one from Killick on YouTube. I have a friend living on Long Island, not too far away from the beach, decided to take their computer and umbrella to the beach for work, posted herself on Instagram, was fired the same day. Oh boy. I hope Tom from Philadelphia has a much less sad story to tell. Tom, you're on Studio 2. What is your perspective on your work and the way work is changing for you?
Yeah, thanks. Yes, definitely less sad. But so in the past year, there have been substantial changes to how work happens. So both from return to office policies and also AI. I think I was sort of talking about how RTO has impacted me and a lot of my coworkers. But, you know, I had been remote for about 8 or 9 years beforehand. And, you know, we structured our life around that. So we made school decisions for our, you know, fifth grade daughter, where she would go to school, understanding that we'd have the capacity for the travel. And, you know, they announced an RTO policy and we had to quickly adjust that. You know, my wife works outside of the home and has long hours, and I was working from home and taking care of, you know, pick up and drop off.
Yeah.
And that all changed pretty dramatically.
Yeah.
You know, so now the variability in the commute time, you know, because traffic in this area is such a boom or bust, you know, I can spend 2 hours a day in the car that I was spending working, for one thing. And the other is, you know, dealing with care, you know, so there's been quite an impact from that perspective.
Yeah. Interesting call from Tom. I wanted to read this comment from Kat, just so, and this is an interesting comment because I think it shows that a lot of people, even themselves, are not quite sure how to feel about all of this. Kat says, I'm a social worker during the pandemic. I was working essentially as a mobile therapist, had to resort to telehealth to meet with clients during the lockdown. I hated working from home because it felt like I didn't have separation between, you know, work and personal life. But now I work in a school I attend every day, and I miss the flexibility and freedom of not having to be somewhere physically for 8 hours a day. I'm planning on finding a job with more flexibility moving forward. Just goes to show, you know, even within one person's experience, there is still this push and pull between remote work and working in the office. We were talking about AI before those two comments. Christine, I'm just curious if you have any insight to add on how much AI is changing or not changing work right now.
Yeah, I think it's a big open question. It's something that we're kind of living in real time, kind of watching how this is shaping jobs. And I think one of the pieces that I would highlight here is that you know, this is not affecting all workers in the same way. So if you think back to, again, you have jobs where, you know, these tools can be a benefit for worker productivity, perhaps. So a lot of people talking about, you know, giving ChatGPT, you know, some of the mundane tasks, you know, putting together some text for, you know, some communication purposes, emails, things like this, you know, that could be great, that could help improve performance and that could be a benefit to workers. But then there are other questions about actually replacing workers wholesale. And I think the question is just going to be how the dust settles on that. And I think it's not a question of whether AI is good or bad. It's a question of for whom and in what context. And I think we'll have to watch carefully and see how this affects workers as we move forward.
Yeah, and I got to read this comment from David on YouTube who says, I feel bad for recent graduates. It seems like the gig economy was created as a response to the high volume of full-time jobs turning into perma temp jobs. It is very difficult finding true full-time work. That's David's comment. So I want to sort of, we have a couple minutes left in the show, and I just want to, you know, talk about young people who are finding it really difficult. I know quite a few. I teach a class at a university, and young, you know, recent graduates say it's hard to on-ramp to their first full-time professional job. Just sort of like, if you guys give some thoughts on or advice for folks, what are their biggest challenges going to be, and what should they sort of be trying to do as they try to navigate the constantly changing job industry? Callum and then Christy.
Sure. It's certainly top of mind for me. I also teach, and I was thinking about recent grads, and I guess this is a commonly used phrase, but I would emphasize those transferable skills, right? The things that will serve you well in the long run. Surely when you're applying for jobs 20, 30 years from now, if you're a new grad, some of those roles are things that don't exist today. And so you're going to have to be able to articulate how your experiences and the skills, the raw skills you developed in one role will transfer to something else. So it's critical thinking, it's communication, it's reflection. It's things like that that will serve you well, even if the job title shifts.
Yeah. And Christy, final word.
Absolutely. Critical thinking is my top line always when it comes to teaching my students and mentoring any students that have questions about hitting the job market. We have no idea, and we'd be lying if we told them that we know what the job market's going to look like in 1 year, in 5 years, in 10 years. But the advantage that we have is being able to process information, take in complexity, and then and try to be critical about that and weighing information and communicating our value. So how do we use these tools, and how do we make sure that we're thoughtful and critical about these changes as they come down the pike? So critical thinking for me is always the top line.
Well, thank you for helping us think critically this hour, Christy McAlpine, assistant professor of management at Rutgers Business School, Camden, and Callum Borchers, on the clock columnist covering workplace trends for the Wall Street Journal. Let me read one more comment from Trisha. I went totally remote when our small office closed in 2024 to save money, but the flexibility is worth it for me. My husband is going through cancer treatments. Our chemo appointments are every Tuesday morning. I also help to care for my 90-year-old mom. And so for Trisha, this trade-off has been worth it.
So many people talking about the benefits of remote work. And of course, we are very much benefited by our producers, Debbie Builder, Hazel Mae Bryan, and Paige Murray Bessler. Mike Schiffler is our visual producer. Al Banks and Tina Calicay engineered today's show. Our executive producer is Kevin McCory. From Studio 2 here at WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Cherry Gregg.
And I'm Avi Wolfman-Arendt. Right back to work tomorrow for us. We'll talk to you then.